see. We shall see what we're looking at this morning. And I want to thank Lois for bringing it about, what, four years ago she was here, and she suggested that we do this. So I think we've really enjoyed it. Right, Gemma?
Yeah.
And I don't think Gemma's ever missed a Bible study.
I've had to.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and you're out of the country, but that doesn't count. So it is June 29th, 2019, and this morning, I'm recording now, so that's why I'm doing this. We're looking at Deuteronomy 23, verse 22, to Deuteronomy 24, verse 18, and the prophetic reading is Isaiah 19, verse 21, and the following verses. So what we've been doing lately is we've just been trying to summarize what did we just read, because it was a lot of stuff, and because we're Protestants, we don't often read the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scripture, and we often don't read laws in general. So let's refresh what we just read and categorize it so that it'll help with memory, and then maybe later connections will come. So go ahead and let's start at the very beginning of what we read in chapter 23, verse 21 in English, but 22 in Hebrew.
Vowels.
Okay, vowels. Do not delay in fulfilling them. So what does that mean? Okay. So a vow in English, sometimes we call it an oath, maybe. In Hebrew it's nedev. And so is a vow important? Just a little, because it says, if you say it, you have to do it. And we'll come back to that in a second. Why do people make vows?
I'm selling a piece of land to my neighbor across the street who wants to build on the same lot. And so, at any rate, I've signed a contract that says, we made a contract that the sale will go through some kind of July.
Right.
So I guess we're signing an oath that if he gives me the stated amount, I would sell the property to him.
So it's kind of like a contract today, a little bit?
Is it?
Right, right. No, it's not exactly, but there's hints of the idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that you promise to do what you say you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
In an old, I don't know, in the Western civilization, or at least in America, you would shake a hand. If you shake hands, it's something like a vow, right? So, Jimmy, you were saying it's more than that. What are you thinking?
What I was thinking was a vow is something you make. And I'm not sure a contract very often involves somebody else. I don't know, but to me, contract isn't strong enough.
Sure.
A vow is something that you make. And I keep thinking of Jephthah's daughter and the whole story of making a vow, and then he really did have to fulfill it. And it's got nothing to do with the person in the end, Jephthah's daughter. I mean, she simply says, yes, you've got to do what the Lord told you to do. But it seems to me it's a very, very strong thing. And like our friend here said, you shouldn't be taking vows. And when the Lord swears, the only person he swears is in his own name. You know?
Right,
so
right.
There's nobody else's name.
Okay, so let's keep all this in mind. Let's keep that category there of vows.
Yeah.
What comes after this in our reading?
Picking, plucking.
Okay, if you're walking through your neighbor's garden, you can pick an apple and eat it, or you can basically eat something, but you can't take something with you. So Brian Kvasnica has a nice story about this. What do we call this? Picking from someone's fields. Brian Kvasnica has a nice story about this. When he first came to Israel in 1994, they were biking around the Sea of Galilee, and they came upon a watermelon patch, huge. And they were poor college students. And so they're like, hey, let's get some watermelon. And so they grabbed four, right? Because you could carry one and one and one and one. And kind of off in the distance, they see this dust, and it's a tractor. And it's coming towards them. And finally, you know, the tractor gets there. The guy jumps out of his tractor, and he runs. He doesn't run. He just comes up to them, and he's speaking to them, and they don't understand what he's saying. And the guy takes one of the watermelons out of his hands and throws it and smashes it on the ground. And then he takes one from the other guy and smashes it on the ground. He's like, you know, basically, you can take one each, but you can't take two. And you can't just take, you know, pillage the fields. So it's a very similar idea here of basically not abusing, I guess you'd call it unknown hospitality. Anyways, as we're going to find out, all of these like laws, you'll find almost every one of them connected to Jesus' teachings, where he will hint or he will allude or he will quote from a lot of what we're reading this morning. So like picking grains in your neighbor's fields, what's that remind you of? With Jesus, correct? Do you remember it was a Sabbath and they were walking through the fields and they were eating grains? So they were basically doing what it was written here in Deuteronomy, but the whole issue there was about the Sabbath. You know, is it lawful to pick grains on the Sabbath? And that's a whole another question. Let's go to the next chapter. Chapter 24.
It's linked to eating them, and eating or gleaning, but not stealing. That's
right, right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
But the thing that connects them is what is considered just personal use, like just enough to kind of satisfy what is considered actually like reaping the harvest.
Yeah.
Gleaning actually is more than personal use, really.
I mean, sure, but if you were just walking through the field picking the grains to eat, or if you're walking through to have one more amount to eat on the way, it would be in a different category. But if you're taking a bunch of
water on his
home, for
later,
less
more
like harvesting or actually.
This, Akana, for you, for our Ugandan friend, I have a Ugandan friend, Millie, who visited here many years ago. I've been studying with her. She's an Old Testament professor in Uganda, and we've been reading through these things. And she said, we follow this in Uganda, and the difference between a little bit is if you bring your sickle, you're stealing.
Right, because that's what it says right here. You can't bring your sickle.
There's nothing after the needs of the poor.
Yeah.
So the rich don't completely overthink.
Yeah. So what did we read here in chapter 24 at the beginning? 24. What?
That's a strange.
It's strange to wives.
You can kind of understand. One husband, somebody marries a woman, and probably she doesn't give her children, and somebody divorces her, and then she goes on to somebody else, and if he divorces her or even dies, then she's not supposed to go back to the first husband. This strikes me as just sort of a bizarre rule.
Well, let's just start with the original thing. can a woman get divorced from her husband?
Not here.
Yeah, not here. Not in this world. Not in the ancient.
No, the husband can write her a letter of divorce.
Yes.
Right.
That's my point. A husband can divorce a wife, but a wife cannot divorce a husband in the time of Deuteronomy here. And it went on for a while, even beyond that, even into the days of Jesus. And so what does Deuteronomy say here that he divorces her for? We kind of talked about this a couple weeks ago.
An indecent thing? Some indecency.
Right. Was it last week? And what is this? What is this indecent thing or offensive or nakedness of a thing? People, well, we don't really know. Let's just say that to start with. And so a lot of the Bible, like a lot of the Bible, needs to be interpreted. This is why interpretation is so key and so important, and why there's so much bad interpretation and good is, it seems to be more like diamonds, is, you know, you can basically take any verse in the Bible and start a war or a cult, or you can do a lot of things. And I mean, you know, the devil quoted scripture to Jesus, and so that's kind of like the abyss of interpretation there. And so that's why we always need to be careful. But just to give an example, what did Jesus say about divorce?
The Lord hates it.
Okay, the Lord hates it.
Jesus said that. Jesus said it wasn't the ideal.
Malachi says the Lord hates it. Jesus says, Jesus is quoting here, okay, if we could just, might as well, just look it up.
Which is incredible because he's basically making a statement about the law not be, the law itself not be representing an ideal.
That's really true. That's true. It's crazy. It's overrated almost.
If you go to Matthew 5, it's 3. Do you want to read it? It's in Dutch. Yeah. Okay. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, and here's where interpretation starts. What do your Bibles have?
Except on the ground of sexual immorality.
Okay. Except for sexual immorality. Anybody have something different there? Makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And this has been written up in the JPs, the Jerusalem Perspectives. If you go to JerusalemPerspective.com, David Bivin has devoted essentially his life to writing these articles or getting articles written by people, scholars who studied here at this church under Bob Lindsay, David Flusser. And this magazine in particular has a whole article or maybe even an issue devoted to this interpretation. Because I think it's King James, but there's a reading, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife commits sexual immorality, or it's something, it's that type of interpretation, basically causes...
Says that makes her commit adultery, even in this version.
No, that's what I'm... Not causes, but make... like, in other words, like, divorce is it. If you get remarried, you're committing sexual immorality. Is how often... I don't know how many people have interpreted that, but apparently a lot in the past. Mm-hmm. And if you understand kind of the background of where this is coming from in Deuteronomy 24, there's this vav, it's and often, it's the word we have for and this will happen.
Well, the first step is to recognize that this whole discussion was taking place in Judaism and in Hebrew.
Right, right.
So Jesus teaching his disciples, while he spoke Aramaic and Hebrew and maybe some Greek, his discussion would have been in Hebrew, and it's based on the Hebrew text of the Old Testament.
Yes.
So then the valid thing of Hebrew having certain formations of his love, certain usages, there's and, that's just and, there's and, that's but, there's and, that's a quarter to. So it depends what usage of and you're talking about.
Right.
Then,
So in other words, there's a high... Right, exactly. That's why I wasn't going to go through it all, because... There. Just take it home. Right.
The bottom line
is this, is that if someone gets divorced in order to marry someone else, that's sexual immorality. That's what the adultery is. It's not that.
So the circumstances afterwards led to you then getting remarried.
Right.
Yeah.
But that you purposely divorced so that you can marry someone else.
Okay. Yes.
Which makes very
We could do a whole Bible study on this, so I don't want to go into it because it's a little complex. Yes, back to Deuteronomy 24. Verse 1, if a man marries a woman who's become displeasing to him or has done something offensive. So there was this whole debate. What does this mean? What is this thing? It's not clear here. And so there was one school of thought in the proto-rabbis or sages, whatever you want to call them. Hillel said, let me start with Shammai. Shammai said that essentially, if she committed sexual immorality, you could divorce. And Jesus also agreed with that. I think it's in Matthew 18. He talks about you can get divorced for sexual immorality on the part of your spouse.
In other words, if the wife commits adultery, she goes off with somebody else or has an affair or whatever it happens to be, he then is justified in
divorce.
In divorcing. She does not have the same right. She goes off and has an affair, she has no power. Right? That's the first thing. The second thing is, that I understand, is that if he does have an affair, and he then wants to marry number two, the girlfriend, and because of that, he then divorces her, he is then committing sexual immorality.
Right.
Yeah.
You have to take it back. You want to have the affair already. Just if you see someone else you want and you divorce this one to get that one, it's saying basically that's adultery.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, back in the Old Testament days, we have lots and lots of multiple adultery wives. Why bother divorcing?
Well, no, Elkanah, he had two wives. That's in Samuel's father.
But there are very few examples, apart from kings and one or two greats, let's say, who had more than two wives. I mean, the idea of having masses of wives, like Solomon, only comes with kings and whatever, doesn't it?
Well, we don't know. Just because it doesn't say it does, you can't automatically assume it didn't. If the kings did it, if the kings had it, you can't really say Joe Blogs down the road can't.
I just want to point... I just want to point out here, coming back to Deuteronomy 24, verses 1, 2, 3, 4, that it's complicated, It's not simple. Even in the days of Jesus, which is 1,000 years later, they're debating, what does this mean and how do we do this? And even today, I mean, Christians are still debating it today. Of course, it's, you know, the whole world's changing in all kinds of ways, for good and for bad. And so, anyways, we don't have time. We got to keep going because it's a huge topic. Go to, and I just want to end with.
Yeah, are you still going to talk about this at all? Or
no, we're done.
Can I say one thing?
Okay.
The idea behind this law of Deuteronomy strikes me as similar to what Jesus was saying. Like, basically, if you see another woman you want and you divorce your wife to get her, you're no better. That is essentially adultery. You're just trying to legalize it. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, what they're describing is a possible situation where you could use a law like, oh, I'm going to divorce you tonight. You can go off with that other person. Now I can just come back and remarry you. So I can essentially just go with whoever I want, just keep passing this divorce thing back and forth, and then we can play ping pong with people. And they're trying to say, like, no, that situation cannot happen.
Yeah. But imagine what would happen. I mean, in that person, they took the animal and they sold it in half. And then the two, the husband and wife, who walked between the two people, showing them they would be put together again. So now it's a breaking covenant. And you know what? Even if you're not a believer and you break covenant in marriage, my parents said they couldn't understand it. They felt like they were only half of themselves. Mm. Exactly. There's a reason for that. And I'm not showing the animal, right, you know.
So you're saying it goes back to Genesis 2:24. Mm-hmm. You know, men's going together. God's going together.
Yeah, no, I don't understand that. And then you're not going to have the peace for the next person. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're thinking it's going to be better for you, but you've been broken up. It's that.
I just want to point out in verse 4, at the very end of all of this, why you don't go back and remarry your wife. It's detestable in the eyes of the Lord. It is justified by saying, do not bring sin upon the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. So I want you just to keep this word in mind, inheritance, as we go forward today. Verse 5, it says, if a man gets married, what does he do for a year? He stays at home and he doesn't go to war.
Makes his wife happy.
Right, makes his wife happy. So again, this is another marriage law or regulation.
And that actually is still implicit in some situations here. It used to be, it's kind of been muddled up recently. You're not supposed to go to war if you're just married.
I'm going to try to speed it up. Speed it up here. In verse 6, we're going to skip around and we're going to see there's going to be a few regulations regarding loans. When someone asks for credit, a line of credit, or they need something, there are certain ways you go about doing it so that you don't hurt the person. Because you know how it is today with, like, say, gambling or drugs, any type of addiction where people basically, or especially used to be alcohol 100 years ago in the U.S., where, you know, families were basically impoverished because of the husband's alcoholism. And so, like in verse 6, it says, essentially, you can't take the millstone away as part of a loan, because the millstone is, you know, it represents a way you make money. So you're it's kind of like debtor's prison was in England, maybe in other countries. Where if you're locked in prison because you owe debts, you'll never be able to repay them. Well, I guess family members could if they went and worked for you, but you essentially cannot repay a debt if you're locked away. I think the U.S. has laws. They have bankruptcy. What do they call those things? Amnesty or something, where you can declare bankruptcy and your debts are wiped away for certain things. Anyways, this idea that you can't abuse someone who's down. And so, like in verse 10, what are the rules? It says you can't go into their house and kind of rough them up. I mean, this is my interpretation. But it says you got to stand outside. You can't go inside. It's very clear. So you can imagine what going inside involves. You know, you could And look in verse 7. This
that ties up with the common law about the way the police can behave. They can only go in. They can't.
With the search warrant.
They need a search warrant to go in. They can't do anything. And if a guy comes out of the house, he can be arrested. But you can't go in without a search warrant or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm an addict of the law.
Verse 7, right? This isn't connected to a loan here, but essentially, this is one of the things I'm thinking when a guy goes into someone's house, he's like, I'm going to take your kid.
Yeah.
You owe me? Because it happens today in Cambodia, Southeast Asia, where kids are parts of Africa, where kids are essentially made slaves because of debts or because...
I mean, I see stories of people going in and saying to an impoverished family, and I'll give you $50 to take little Jimmy, and they take Jimmy into slavery.
This is one verse where the harshness of it doesn't grate against me, where it says the kidnapper must die.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah.
Okay, so this is... This, you know? Right. This is interesting that you brought that up, because this slaver gets killed for enslaving one of his own people. See, because we can go into, because this is where things get all messy, because in the Bible it doesn't talk about other people's, you know, like captives of war. That's a different, whole different thing. But when it comes to your own type of people, specifically the Israelites here, it's the death penalty.
Yeah.
This is like child trafficking.
Child trafficking. But I want to point this one thing out. If you were to go and look at the Ten Commandments, and like that's in Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5, there's two sets of them right there. And, you know, what are they? You keep Shabbat, you don't make images, you don't murder, don't lie. What else? Okay, it says don't steal. And the rabbis were like, this is weird. Don't steal? Why is it up here with murder and all of these things that are much on a higher level? And so one interpretation of this was stealing people, kidnapping. Because the word's the same word here, ganav. So
it says if you're ending your life.
Right.
If you sell them as a slave, they have no future. You've cut them off.
Yeah.
You've cut them off from inheritance.
Yeah. Okay, go down to verse 14, Deuteronomy 24:14. I mean, this is a, I hate to say it, but this is a, if you want to get into politics, we're getting to socialism here. If you're going to hire a day laborer, you have to pay them, you know, that day. You've got to, you cannot withhold wages. But then I guess you could then come down and say in verse 16 it's a capitalist politic here. Everyone is punished for their own sin, right? It's not the community. The whole community doesn't get punished for what this one person did. The father is not punished for the son's sin. The son's not punished for the father's sins. And so today you could ask around politically, is that happening among us, among different people, where a family gets punished for someone's sin? And you could go in, you could try to extract all of that and ask, what's the reasoning behind
it? Well, there were punishments in ancient Near East.
Oh, no, the Bible's full of it.
No,
I'm saying like Achan, right? Achan stole the gold thing. His entire family got killed for it.
Sure.
But this is, you're talking about a bull. It's different.
Or
if it's a known gore. If you're building something and you kill the guy's son, then your son, you have to replace his son with your son.
It's not that you replace it. No. It's that you just get yours killed, but right? Just to make it, you both lose the son.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's tit for tat, and it's a misunderstanding of an
Or we pay the person who actually did it.
But I want to go beyond all of that. I just want to point out that the Bible, like a lot of these things are nice. They're like, we have human rights today that are based on a lot of these ideas. But the Bible also has doublespeak, like I just pointed out. On one hand, the son's not, doesn't get punished for the father, but you have the story of Achan. He took, gold idols or something, and his son did die for that, including everything else with him. Of course, you could argue in that case, God did it. The whole earth opened up and killed them, right? But, they stoned them. They stoned them. But that was Korah. That's right. Yes, Randy?
I don't see how verse 14 relates to capitalism or socialism. Verse 14 seems to be simple justice for individual workers.
I agree. Justice is a huge deal, but there are political systems today that lean one way or the other based off of who's in control. And in these texts, it's saying if someone's an orphan, if someone's a widow, if someone is an immigrant from outside the land, if someone...
You can't take a pledge from them.
Yeah.
Basically, you have to give them stuff for free.
But exactly.
This is not about pledges. Verse 14 is about...
In verse 17 it is. Verse 17.
Right, but in 14, which Brandon was talking about, is to do with hiring somebody. And I mean, there are people up on the streets, they'll give you a day's work, you come and build my fence and do whatever, and then they say, you didn't do it well enough, piss off. And I mean, but I think it's strict justice, isn't it?
No, of course, it's pure justice. But if you use the word justice in this country today, they put you on this side of the political spectrum. Oh, yeah. Just that word. I wrote an article once where I used the word justice, and they immediately were like, well, you're over here, because I believe in justice. And I agree with you that, you know, at the base, it is justice, and God is just. But how you interpret that justice is the key.
And in today's political discourse, you talk about workers' rights, that also puts you on a map somewhere.
Yeah, they peg you.
Increasing workers' rights over against...
Corporate business
interest.
Verses 17 to 21 or 22, let's say, is describing why you should basically give away for free to the disenfranchised in your society,
in your community,
and say, remember that you are slaves.
Okay, right? So this is, we don't have a lot of time, and this is where I want to go right now. The very last sentence. Or last, read the last two verses, 17, 18.
Do you mean 17, 18, or do you mean?
Do not deprive the foreigner or the fatherless of justice, or take the cloak of the widow as a pledge. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. That is why I command you to do this.
And then in 22, exactly the same thing. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, therefore I command you to do this thing. So it's twice over.
What do these, all of these people have in common? That's my question. Okay, they're Israelites.
No, they're aliens.
But you're, yeah, not the aliens.
They don't have property.
Okay. They don't have property. They're vulnerable. Thank you. I would say, yeah, they're defenseless. They're this week we got hit by a car as we're pulling in. As Sharon was backing in, this lady, you know, like is okay.
She
I don't.
Tried want,
she tried to go around because she didn't have sublimates, right? And we hit. Okay, and so immediately here it's. You know, like it's your, you did it and all of this. And obviously Sharon had her blinker on, you know, the law is, you're just a, at least I hope it is here in civilized countries it is. But that you're just to wait for the person to park and all of that. But, and it's the kind of thing where I immediately started thinking of, I know this other guy who had a scooter and he got taken they pulled him over, and he didn't have his license. And he's a foreigner, and he had went to court. He had to go to court, and essentially they charged him, I think it was 7,000 to 8,000 shekels. And because he didn't speak Hebrew, and they just, I mean, he spoke a little bit, he understood a little bit, but basically the judge said something like, oh, this guy is not, you know, whatever, give him the full thing. And I'm sure all of you can relate to different times you've been in other places as a minority or anywhere, and, you know, if you don't know the powers that be in that society, or you're not part of the collective, you know, society, you are at a disadvantage. And so here we're hearkening back to Egypt, where Joseph has brought his family, and things are going well, but they become enslaved, according to the Bible, for over 400 years. And in a sense, they're, you know, they're defenseless. And it's God who frees them. That's the whole point of Passover, and that's the, you know, the power of it. And so I want to go now to Isaiah 19, and then let's tie this up. Anyways, when that accident happened with us, I just started thinking, I started connecting the dots. Because, you know, this one lady is walking along the road, pulls up, she's like, yeah, you know, blaming us for whatever. And, you know, I'm just thinking, this isn't going to end well. And at the end of the day, I think the lady was in a hurry, and her car already had so many dings, she couldn't even tell where it was. So that's how it ended. So at, yeah, she smashed our car, you know, and we should have gotten her information, but whatever.
Yeah.
Isaiah 19.
In that day, wonderful verses.
Yes. You know what? Let's just start with verse 1, Isaiah 19. What is the context here? A prophecy against Egypt. See, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and is coming to Egypt. The idols of Egypt tremble before him, and the hearts of the Egyptians melt with fear. I will stir up Egyptian against Egyptian. So I'm in verse 2. Brother will fight against brother, neighbor against neighbor, city against city, kingdom against kingdom. The Egyptians will lose heart, and I will bring their plans to nothing. They will consult the idols, the spirits of the dead, the mediums, the spiritists. I will hand the Egyptians over to the power of a cruel master. A fierce king will rule over them. Verse 5, the waters of the river will dry up. The riverbed will be parched and dry, and the canals will stink. What's that, Isaiah 19? What does that harken back to?
Egypt
and the plagues a little bit. There's a little something there. The blood in the water, right?
It makes them foul. And even doesn't have to be the blood. It can be the frogs. It can be anything. It also
yeah,
turns the river foul.
Because the fish, the frogs die and they stink.
The plagues all affected. Maybe all affected.
Yeah. Verse 11. The officials of Zoan are nothing but fools. The wise counselors of Pharaoh give senseless advice. How can you say to Pharaoh, I am one of the wise men, a disciple of the ancient kings? And again, you kind of think back to the plagues, because he's got his wise men, the ones who are, they do a few of the first signs and wonders, but here they are not anything but fools. Then let's go to verse 16. So all of this is negative. Verse 16, in that day the Egyptians will become weaklings. They will shudder with fear at the uplifted hand that the Lord Almighty raises against them. The land of Judah will bring terror to the Egyptians. Everyone to whom Judah is mentioned will be terrified. So here we have a change in kind of the ancient pecking order. Now the Egyptians, who are usually on top, are afraid of Judah, which Judah was nothing in the whole world order compared to Babylon and Assyria and Egypt. Judah was always kind of getting run over. Verse 18, in that day, five cities in Egypt will speak the language of Canaan and swear allegiance to the Lord Almighty. One of them will be called the City of the Sun. In that day, there will be an altar to the Lord. And when we say the Lord, it's Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, right? So this is specifically the personal God of Israel. There will be an altar to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, to the Lord in the heart of Egypt, and a monument to the Lord at its border. It will be a sign and a witness to the Lord Almighty in the land of Egypt when they cry out to the Lord because of their oppressors. What does that remind you of? When they cry out to the Lord because of their oppressors. Right? That's also going back to Exodus. Is it the last verse of Exodus 1? It says, like, he heard their cries. So, yeah. And he says he will...
But here, it's Egypt who's doing the crying.
Yes. So, yes.
Not the Israelites.
Yes.
So we've had a complete switch from the beginning of the chapter.
Yes.
And suddenly now we get Judah oppressing Egypt, and it's the Egyptians who are crying out. And the interesting thing is that they do start to speak the language of heaven or the language of Hebrew or whatever it is. And they worship the Lord and offer sacrifice. Well, that's pretty special.
Well, it says they're speaking the Canaanite language. So I don't know if Randy wants to weigh in on what that could
be.
Okay, I mean, it's
Hebrew,
it's Semitic. I mean,
it's less than Semitic. It's Canaanite is a collection of dialects that goes from down near Aqaba and Eilat all the way up past Beirut. That whole area, they speak a language they can understand.
So my question is, in verse 18, when it says the language of Canaan, hold on. Okay, but I mean, what's the interpretation of it? They're speaking Hebrew because they've been conquered by them, or what?
Well, in the following verses, it sounds like it's because they are followers of the Lord.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yehudit.
Well, because at that time the kingdom was divided, and so they weren't referring. Isaiah was not actually referring to his own dialect as Hebrew. He was referring to it as Yehudit.
Right.
And the northern kingdom would be Israel.
It's a regional.
Moabit was also Canaanite, and Philippite was Canaanite, and Edomite was Canaanite. They all understood each other.
So now we're at our verse here, verse 21. So the Lord will make himself known to the Egyptians, and in that day they will acknowledge the Lord. They will worship with sacrifices and grain offerings. They will make vows to the Lord and keep them. The Lord will strike Egypt with a plague. He will strike them and heal them. Okay, this is strange. Why is God striking them with a plague if they've already come under his guidance or worship? They will turn to the Lord, and he will respond to their pleas and heal them. In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. The Assyrians will go to Egypt, and the Egyptians to Assyria. The Egyptians and Assyrians will worship together. In that day, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on the earth. The Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance.
That's an amazing one.
Yes.
Well, that was a very good question, Gary, back in verse 22, because if they're already acknowledging the Lord, they already know the Lord, and they will bow to the Lord, and they will pay it. And then it says, and the Lord will knock Egypt, knocking them and healing them. And you could either read that as some kind of a prediction that it'll be in a wave, there'll be a good wave, and then times will change, and they'll backslide and you'll need to be hit again. It could actually be a prediction of a second restoration, or it could be simply a backflash that isn't being marked. Sometimes the writers assume you're nimble enough in your thinking, you're flexible enough so that you can reset yourself on your own without any signal from the author. You reset, and so you're going back to the time when they're being hit because they're not followers of the Lord, and then he heals them to bring them into a situation. So it's either unmarked repetition, or it is a secondary falling away in restoration.
Now, like the Lord will have struck Egypt with a plague, and this is where he will have struck him.
Well, that's very fancy English to try to mark that resetting. But the Hebrew doesn't mark the resetting here. It just assumes you either do it on your own, or it's a secondary restoration.
It could be a narrative flashback.
Exactly.
Okay.
But it's not marked. It's an unmarked flashback.
Right.
That's the distinction.
But the thing that strikes me is that right now Egypt is in terrible shape, partly because of the dams that have been placed upstream. What is it? Sudan? South Sudan? Someplace upstream on the Nile.
It's...
rejoice that if this is a future prophetic word, which I believe it is, that the situation will change.
Okay,
and so then you go on to 23 to the end, which is the famous Isaiah 19 ministry, really, which is talking about this highway that was going to be between.
Yeah, but before we go to the future, I want to go to the past.
Egypt.
Why are we connecting these two sections of scripture? Yes.
The whole thing about vows. On one hand, there's a string of all those old laws or vows that one was taking about what you had treated people, what you did.
Who's taking the vow?
In this situation now,
in Egypt. In Isaiah, Egypt's taking vows and paying them to God.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, and she is keeping
them. And
they
will make
vows. One of the first things we got today was that when you make a vow, you've got to speedily do it.
Mm-hmm.
And here it seems to be they are.
So, obviously, the first big connection is it's in the first verse.
Mm-hmm.
In each case, it's vows. And we know from the context of Isaiah, it's about Egypt. And I mean, that's the context, it explicitly says this. And then coming back to Iran, we've had a lot of talk about Egypt as well. And because you were slaves in Egypt, and there's a lot of these, I mean, it might be more of a stretch to tie it into the defenseless and the weak in the society here, but you have definitely an allusion to Egypt.
And allusions in Isaiah, going back to the 10 strikes.
Yes, yeah.
Even including the starting verse, the Nolda, the Lai Beni Sarai, Lord will be known to Egypt because in the 10th place it says God saw their vision and he knew.
Right.
And there's no object there, it's just kind of hanging.
Right.
And it's kind of like he knew, he experienced their pain.
So I have another theory about the vows, why the Egyptians are making vows and then they're being struck and they're being healed. Is, I mean, if you look at the vows that are usually done, like say Jacob in Genesis 28, or Yiftach in Judges 11, or Hannah in 1 Samuel 1, or so on and so on, what's the purpose of a vow? That's what we didn't actually kind of...
You're in a crisis.
You're in a crisis.
You need to get out.
You need to get out. You're
see,
in a tight...
If you help me out, I'm going to do this.
Remember the sailors in Jonah? The ship is going to sink, they make vows. And so, and then, God does his thing, and then every time it says if you do a vow, what do you have to do? You have to fulfill it, or you have to pay it off. Because there's, if you want to get out of a vow, you can do that. And you read Numbers 30, it goes through this whole system of, you know, if you vow this cow, you've got to pay this much money to get out of it. It's got like a tax on it or something. And also if you start vowing, you know,
Jeff would rather kill his daughter than pay that cow.
Yeah, again, we're going to go into that because that's a whole other study. Judges is out of control. It's the Wild West. But essentially, you have to pay your vows. If you read the Psalms, it's constantly saying, Lord, I'm going to come up and I'm going to pay my vows. It says it multiple times. You know, you come to the temple. Who paid their vows in Jerusalem after Jesus from the book of Acts? Paul. Paul came up to the temple in Acts 20, 21, and he pays vows for, was it some Nazarites or something? Or I can't remember. It's important that you pay what you say you're going to do. And so maybe in the case with Egypt, these vows are, they're being struck, and then the Lord heals. He fulfills the vow. Anyways, that's a stretch, but still.
But the vows in Deuteronomy are really sort of very practical linked things. They're all to do with justice on the, if you look at the whole thing as a whole, not just the one verse.
Uh-huh.
And they're individual. And if you do it, ultimately you will inherit the land and be blessed.
Right.
And yet in this, in Isaiah, it's exactly the same, but it's more to do with the relationship between a people of God rather than an individual.
You have the example in Deuteronomy, or no, it's in Numbers, where they say if we're able to wipe out this people, we'll keep this vow. It's like Numbers, I'll have to find it. Like where you dedicated a certain thing. So I think you can have vows that are more than just personal.
What I'm saying is the connection between the two is that whereas Deuteronomy tends to be around the personal, and it's also to do with the blessing or whatever that will come on the individual or the family, let's say, in the Haftarah, it's more to do with Egypt and what a whole nation does when a whole nation turns, when a nation cries out to the Lord.
Right.
And makes vows and promises and keeps them or doesn't or whatever.
Right.
Is that not right?
I mean, sure.
I'm looking at the connections between the two.
There's also a connection to Judges here.
But I also think you could go back and interpret it, read it, and like Israel.
Right.
Yeah, if Egypt's making vows, Israel has made many vows with the Lord. You know, if you go to Deuteronomy 30 and the Ten Commandments and the Torah and all of this, there's these covenants, or maybe it doesn't use the word vow, but it's the same idea of what Egypt is doing here. And Israel's constantly breaking it, right? That's the other thing.
That's right. And Israel gets punished.
Right, and then they call out to the Lord, and He redeems them.
Eventually.
Yeah.
The time span between the breaking, going off to other gods, or whatever it happens to be,
right,
is very often, they're really brought very, very low.
Yeah.
Before they get around to chatting about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the story of our lives.
Yep.
I think there probably are a whole lot of commercial problems. At the same time, the farmers, you know, you plant a crop, later, and you vow that you're going to pay back for the seed or whatever it is you've got that allowed you to have the crop. Or somebody vows that their child will be able to be married after they work for such and such length of time. So it's a practical
parent. Right. We can give a vow.
She's saying if we're alive for Jesus, we think Jesus, we can't give a vow.
Right. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Jesus said it's better not to,
Right.
Actually, Deuteronomy says it's better not to also.
Yeah.
That if you stop making vows, you won't sin.
Well, actually, I think Jesus, where in Matthew 5, where he's saying, you know, don't let your SBS in, nobody know. I think he's getting that from Ecclesiastes chapter 5, Kohelet, it says basically the same thing.
Are these vows necessarily, and we have the word vow in the general sense of pronouncing other people, mm-hmm. but these sound like prayerful.
This is to God. Yeah, right.
Just like in Jonah, you know, the other sailors, they vow vows, you know.
Yeah.
It's like a prayer where, oh, God, please save us, we'll give you stuff.
Right.
I think that's more specific.
Is the word Neda?
Yes, right.
Neda means a vow.
They vow to the Lord.
Yeah.
In verse 21.
Yeah. Are you what?
The whole logic of vows, like what Jesus says, let your yes be yes, and your no be no. Like, it's like when someone says, no, I swear. It's like, well, before you said you swore,
and you
everything
broke
else
it.
You were saying was only an afterlife. It cheapens the rest of the way that you talk. And the same thing with Jephthah, like offering his daughter or any of these other things. Like, it assumes that God is like the mafia. It assumes that like God wants to
money.
Take all this extra stuff, like the mafia does. You go to make these ridiculous deals with the mafia of like 30% and all this stuff because you know they're greedy,
yeah.
And you know they really want it. But like, and so when Jephthah makes this deal and give his daughter, like, why would he assume that God wants him to do his daughter in the first place? He doesn't. It's stupid logic on the part of.
Well, it shows you Jephthah's relationship with God, right?
Yeah, messed up.
It's kind of lacking.
It's a sick view of God. It's a sick view of the world. It's a sick view of yourself.
But yeah. Danny, in Jephthah's case, he didn't know what the consequences was. I mean, it's a sick view of oneself and one's relationship with God.
But
God wants this. I mean, he just has, makes this crazy.
He has to come out of my house. What was he thinking?
Fighting you.
Sons.
The son that should inherit them. And when you do that is like the biggest plea for help.
That was Moab, right? The Moabite king. Okay, sorry, we've run out of time. I just want to end with this one little, I thought it was interesting point, is the three, Assyria, Egypt, and Assyria, they're all given descriptors. What are they? They're all described as something related to God. Egypt is... my people. That's really, whoa. Assyria is my handiwork, work of my hands. Okay, that's also very nice. And then, but what is Israel?
Inheritance.
And there's, again, that connection back to Deuteronomy 24 about the land, you know, you are my inheritance, but this land is also the inheritance as well. And it's God. So Isaiah 19 also has that word nachalah there for inheritance. And it's very, very fascinating. So Shabbat Shalom.